Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Bankston of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who examines the Obama administration's effort to establish broad new regulations enabling the government to more easily spy on internet communications. Ashley Nellis, a research analyst with the Sentencing Project, who challenges court sentences of life without parole for youth found guilty of capital crimes. And author and environmental activist Bill McKibben, who discusses the grave threat facing the planet from global warming and his group's International Day of Action on Climate Change on October 10th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Nation magazine reports that companies tied to Blackwater founder Eric Prince have worked on security and intelligence contracts for pro-Western governments and multinational companies like Monsanto, Disney, and Deutsche Bank. Through these companies, Total Intelligence Solutions and Terrorism Research Center, Prince has engaged in covert operations with CIA operatives and done undercover work for corporate executives, including spying on environmental activists. Top clients include the Kingdom of Jordan, the Canadian military, and the Dutch police, as well as several major U.S. military bases, including Fort Bragg, home of the elite Joint Special Forces Operations Command. A key contact for Blackwater's covert operation with the CIA was former officer Enrique Rick Prado, who set up a global network of foreign operatives. The CIA has long used proxy forces to hide the involvement of the American government in covert operations. Starting in 2004, Prado and Prince were active in the CIA's assassination program. Monsanto was Total Intelligence Solutions' most controversial client, paying over $200,000 in 2008 and 2009 for intelligence services and protection from critics of genetically modified seeds. Total Intelligence Solutions insists it did not work to infiltrate groups critical of Monsanto, but it did provide reports to the biotech giant of groups and individuals considered a risk to the company. Michelle Bachelet, former president of Chile, has been handpicked to lead the new United Nations Agency for Gender Equality. Bachelet, a single mother and agnostic from a predominantly Catholic country, headed a center-left government in Chile that embraced free trade and globalization. A trained physician, Bachelet brings a wide breadth of experience in reproductive rights, domestic violence, and the abuse of women in conflict zones. Bachelet's appointment by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon came as a mild surprise. African countries had campaigned rigorously to get the appointment. Bachelet is seen by some nations in the global south as too close to the United States and not sympathetic enough with struggling low-income countries in Africa and South Asia. In an interview with The Nation magazine, Bachelet dismissed these criticisms. She declared, "The state has to guarantee people's rights, especially for the most vulnerable people and the people living in the most difficult situations." Once democracy was restored in Chile in 1990, Bachelet joined the government to work as an epidemiologist and an expert on HIV/AIDS. The new UN agency is an outgrowth of the Agenda on Women's Empowerment set at the 1995 Beijing Women's Conference, which called for aggressive action against gender discrimination in areas like education, employment, healthcare, and political participation. The last General Electric factory making old-style incandescent light bulbs in the United States closed its doors in September, laying off 200 workers in Virginia. During the current deep recession, corporate leaders and the Obama administration have pinned their hopes on advances in green technology to jumpstart American manufacturing, which has been shedding jobs for decades. But green jobs have not yet arrived, especially for workers in traditional manufacturing. The jobs at the GE plant became vulnerable because of the 2007 energy conservation law that essentially banned the use of incandescent bulbs after 2014. The old bulbs are being replaced by energy-efficient compact fluorescent bulbs, CFCs, that are made in China. Ironically, the basic technology for the CFC bulbs was developed by GE engineers in the 1970s, but it was never commercialized until Chinese businessman Ellis Yen automated production to make the energy-efficient bulbs profitable. Yen now controls half of all CFC production and is looking into building a factory in the U.S., but has failed thus far to get $12.5 million in government funding to build the plant. Today, making a CFC bulb in the U.S. would add 10% to the cost of production, but retailers say there is a market for made-in-the-USA CFC light bulbs. Jobs at the GE factory paid well, about $30 an hour, but today there are few jobs that pay that well near the plant in Winchester, Virginia. Many of the workers who are in their 40s and 50s are considering retiring on their severance payments. Others are hoping to secure jobs in the expanding solar industry. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Federal law enforcement and national security officials in the Obama administration are planning to seek broad new regulations next year that will enable the government to more easily spy on criminal and terrorist suspects' communications over the Internet. The goal is to facilitate government access to targeted encrypted email transmitted over cell phone systems like BlackBerry, social networking websites like Twitter and Facebook, as well as direct messaging via peer-to-peer communications through systems like Skype. Although a 1994 telecommunications law called the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act, or CALEA, requires phone and broadband companies to build in backdoor wiretapping technology used by the government, Internet-based social networking companies are not covered under current law. Employing a rationale similar to that of the Obama administration, nations such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates recently announced a prohibition on the use of BlackBerry wireless devices because the company's standard encryption makes it difficult to intercept and decode messages. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who examines the threats to privacy he sees in the White House's new policy on monitoring electronic communication.
What the administration would like to do is take the requirement that services be designed to facilitate government wiretapping and expand them beyond the small group of telecoms that were initially covered or the small group of broadband providers and VoIP providers that were covered in 2005 to cover apparently pretty much any kind of electronic communication service that exists online, be it a chat provider or an email provider or a video chat provider or anyone else. So Facebook, Skype, instant messaging services, etc. They seem to want to be able to prevent any kind of end-to-end secure encryption that a provider can't decrypt. And they also seem to want to prevent any kind of true peer-to-peer communications that don't go through a centralized provider. How they would accomplish that without attempting to ban those technologies outright or force the installation of wiretapping software on everybody's computers and phones is, at this point, very unclear.
In what they propose, are they presupposing that there will be checks and balances, court warrants for such surveillance, regardless of the technology?
Part of their argument is that they are not seeking an expansion of their wiretapping authority, and that this would only be used when the government gets a wiretap order from a court based on probable cause. And there are a couple of responses to that. First off, there are demonstrated abuses where the government has taken advantage of technology to wiretap internet and phone communications without getting the appropriate process. See, in particular, the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program, which may have made use of CALEA equipment. But also, to the extent they're saying, well, we're just trying to facilitate what we're already authorized to do, that logic kind of falls apart if you look at the real world. In the real world, the government has the authority, if it goes to court and gets a warrant, to come and secretly search your house or to install an eavesdropping device in your house to eavesdrop on your private conversations. But that doesn't mean that we require all houses to be built with peepholes for the government to use when and if they get a warrant, or with pre-installed eavesdropping bugs that they can turn on when they have the appropriate legal process. We wouldn't engineer those kinds of insecurities into our real-world facilities, and we shouldn't do it online, particularly because although we don't seem to have any clear demonstrated need for this update to the law, the government's only run into encryption once in its wiretaps last year, and it didn't stop them from getting the data they needed. What we do have a record of is how these sort of CALEA or quote-unquote lawful intercept systems have created a security vulnerability. When you build in these back doors into communication systems for use by the government, you risk other people, be they identity thieves or black hat hackers or even foreign governments, to try and exploit them. And we've actually seen this a few times. First off, in Greece in 2005, the lawful intercept equipment for cell phone calls that had been installed by decree of the government actually got exploited by parties still unknown to do wiretaps on over 100 high-ranking Greek government officials, including their prime minister, which is really shocking. This surveillance infrastructure mandated by the government was actually used by unknown parties, turned around on the very government that had ordered it to be installed. And now there's a later example, which is the Chinese intrusion into Google systems, which reportedly also was done by exploiting the lawful intercept hardware and software that Google has installed to help with government wiretapping. So when the government says, we need this reengineering of the internet to facilitate our surveillance, it needs to be understood that we're likely going to be facilitating surveillance by other people too, if this actually happens.
In your view, what would the precedent be if the Obama administration and the U.S. government adopted some of these sweeping laws to install backdoors on every type of electronic communications? We know that the oil-rich nation of Dubai, Iran, and China have all tried to prevent various communication systems from being used in their countries unless they had a key to surveil that communication system. Doesn't this Obama administration proposal really kind of validate what these other less than democratic countries are trying to do in their own nations?
Indeed. It seems, particularly in light of the recent controversy over the United Arab Emirates' treatment of BlackBerry, where that country threatened to block BlackBerry email traffic because BlackBerry, or rather the company that runs BlackBerry, RIM, provides encryption without having the keys to decrypt. This administration proposal seems both hypocritical to the extent that the United States criticized that push by the United Arab Emirates, but also would seem to embolden regimes such as that in Dubai or India or China or other countries that are less supportive of fundamental civil liberties. I can only imagine that the governments in those countries are rubbing their hands with glee at anticipation of having this new arrow in their argumentative quiver, being able to say, well, hey, the United States is doing it. Why the heck shouldn't we be able to? So rather than taking these steps to break the internet and threaten everybody's privacy and security and hinder innovation and impact the tech economy, our suggestion humbly is that they use the tools they already have.
That was Kevin Bankston, Senior Staff Attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 415-436-9333 or visit their website at EFF.org. Advocates for those incarcerated for life without parole for crimes committed when they were juveniles have taken heart from a U.S. Supreme Court decision in May. The justices ruled that a sentence of life without parole for minors convicted of crimes other than murder is unconstitutional. At the time, 130 persons were serving such a sentence, more than half of them in Florida. Now, lawyers are pushing to see if various extenuating circumstances surrounding their own juvenile clients' convictions for murder might also be addressed. According to a report by the Equal Justice Initiative, many youth who receive sentences of life without parole don't have the ability to pay for a private attorney. Most of them come from low-income families, and some come from intense poverty. Many of them are raised in abusive homes and are more vulnerable to getting swept up into violence. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ashley Nellis, a research analyst with the Sentencing Project. She talks about the kinds of crimes that can lead to life without parole and hopes that the Supreme Court will address the issue head on.
The Supreme Court case that was decided in May of this year, called Graham v. Florida, and determined that people who were under the age of 18 at the time of their offense, who did not commit a homicide, cannot be given a sentence of juvenile life without parole. And that applies to about 130, 129 people around the nation, 77 of whom are serving their time in Florida, so it's very disproportionately applied in that state.
How could they be serving life without parole, what you call JWAP, if they weren't convicted of a murder? What were they convicted of?
It depends on the state, but you can be, depending on state law, you know, many states you can only get JLWAP if you have a homicide, and that's why 2,000 people are serving the sentence for homicide. But in some states you can get it for arson or kidnapping, sexual assault, armed burglary, which is what Mr. Graham had, armed robbery, and other offenses that aren't coming to mind right now. So there are lots of non-homicide offenses that, depending on state law, could have given somebody juvenile life without parole. And in some states like Florida, it's a mandatory juvenile life without parole for many of those crimes. So that's why they had so many serving there in Florida.
So, Ashley Nellis, since the Supreme Court decision in May, what have been some of the developments?
There have been, you know, there's certainly been a lot of discussions and sort of strategies around how to, you know, best interpret the decision and everything. And from what I understand, there are a number of cases where folks are wondering if their case applies under Graham because they were not the trigger man, not the person that actually did the killing, or they were did not intend to for somebody to die during their crime. For instance, in the case of a burglary, perhaps somebody was home, but they didn't expect them to be, and in a moment of bad judgment, they killed them. So there's a lot of interest among advocates and people who are serving as attorneys for these folks that are trying to see if the Graham opinion can extend to other people serving juvenile life without parole as well.
You know, when you say a moment of bad judgment and somebody dies, I can hear a lot of people saying, well, they deserve it then. But I think it's important to make a distinction between juveniles who are convicted of these crimes and adults. That's part of the argument, right?
Yeah, that was a major part of the argument in the Graham case, and also in the Roper v. Simmons case, which was in 2005, which ruled it unconstitutional for juveniles to get the death penalty. Both of them are basically founded on the notion that juveniles are different than adults in very important ways. Most importantly, they have an underdeveloped brain. They have a lack of maturity. They have a lack of ability to sort of appreciate the consequences of their actions. Anyone with young children knows that. Anyone with a teenager knows that the decisions you make as a teenager are far different than the decisions you make when you're older. And also, young people are more susceptible to peer pressure, especially negative peer pressure. And so we know that juvenile crime tends to happen in groups much more than it does for older individuals, and kids can get swept up in bad ideas more easily when they're young.
You said there are 2,000 people serving life without parole for homicides committed when they were juveniles, and the number serving life without parole for non-homicides is much smaller.
Yeah, the vast majority of people serving juvenile life without parole in the United States are there for a homicide, about 2,000. So it's a tiny fraction of the total number of people sentenced for juvenile life without parole, which is very important when you put in the context of the fact that no other country in the world uses this practice. So the fact that we have 2,500 maybe people serving juvenile life without parole, the great majority of whom are there for homicide, you know, really sets the United States far apart from any other nation.
Is there another case that might be headed to the Supreme Court that would deal with this issue?
I don't know. I mean, you know, certainly in an ideal world, the Supreme Court will pick up a case that deals with life sentence for homicides. But, you know, the court was not asked to answer that question in this case. So that's an important, you know, fact about this. The court has not said that it's okay for juveniles to get life without parole for homicide because they weren't asked that in the Graham case. know, and we hope that, an appropriate case will move its way up the courts and end up with the Supreme Court so that they can answer that question. And, we're optimistic that they would answer it in the way that they did in Roper, which is that children are different. No matter what their crime, they're still different.
That was Ashley Nellis of the Sentencing Project. Contact the project by calling their Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-628-0871 or visit their website at sentencingproject.org. In early September, author, journalist, and climate change activist Bill McKibben traveled from Maine to Washington, D.C. with some of his students and a solar panel once installed in the White House during Jimmy Carter's presidency. Their mission was to convince President Obama to symbolically reinstall solar technology on his White House in an era where global warming threatens the planet's fragile ecosystem. The solar panel he towed from Maine had originally been installed on Carter's White House in 1979, where it produced hot water until it was torn down by Ronald Reagan, a sign of his administration's contempt for alternative energy technology. Once in Washington, McKibben, who first warned about global warming in 1989, met with a few low-level government officials, but left the meeting frustrated with what seemed to be a rejection of his idea. But on October 5th, Energy Secretary Stephen Chu announced plans to install solar panels and a solar hot water heater on the White House roof by the end of next spring, as he inaugurated the GreenGov Symposium, which promoted sustainable technology throughout the federal government. Despite grave setbacks on addressing climate change at last year's Copenhagen Climate Conference and the lack of congressional cap-and-trade legislation in the U.S., McKibben remains hopeful that the people of the world will work to pressure political leaders to take the necessary action to protect the world from the ravages of global warming. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with McKibben about his new book, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, and his group's Global Day of Action on Climate Change Solutions on October 10th.
We've known all along that there's a certain amount of global warming that we're not going to stop because it's already happening, and we can see that after this brutal hot summer. That's about, so far, 1 degree on average of temperature increase around the world. We've got another degree in the pipeline that we've already committed to. But the climatologists tell us that if we don't work very quickly to get off fossil fuel, we'll see 4 or 5 degrees before the century is out. And there is a world of difference between 2 degrees and 5 degrees globally averaged. It may well be the difference between a difficult century and an impossible one. So our work at 350.org very much continues, and we're building as fast as we can as big and powerful a movement to take on the fossil fuel industry as we can mount.
Bill, as you wrote this book, you recognized that climate change has already taken its toll on the planet's ecosystem, and you summarized some devastating statistics about ice melt, the drought affecting many parts of the world, increasing amounts of acid in our oceans, intensifying storms, floods. We're certainly seeing the floods in the Indus River in Pakistan. Review that for us, if you would.
Let's just talk about the events of the last few months. Look at what's going on. 19 nations have set new all-time heat records this summer. In Pakistan in May, they set the all-time temperature record for all of Asia, 129 degrees. The Arctic is melting very quickly. As you'll recall, a chunk of ice 4 times the size of Manhattan dropped off the edge of Greenland and into the ocean. Meanwhile, Russia has just suffered through the most astonishing heat wave in its 1,000 years of civilization, at least according to the country's chief meteorologist. It was enough to cause epic fires across central Russia and enough to convince the Kremlin to cease the export of grain to the rest of the world. And, of course, as you said earlier, the most powerful images of the summer, probably even more than the horrible spill in the Gulf, may be that spill of water down the Indus River in Pakistan. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. The atmosphere is 4 or 5% moister than it was 40 years ago. And that sets us up for these astonishing deluges, these record downpours that we're now seeing all over the earth. I mean, we've seen them around this country this year, Nashville, Oklahoma City, the mountains of Arkansas, Texas-Mexico border, all with big loss of life. But the most spectacular one, unfortunately, was what happened in the high mountains of Asia when the monsoon dropped more rain than it ever had before, and that flow down the Indus caused the most heartbreaking havoc and chaos for 20 million people, an almost unimaginable number.
Well, Bill McKibben, as you said a moment ago, your work at the Climate Change Awareness Group 350.org continues to tell the story of what's at stake if we don't change some fundamental ways we live and use energy. How are we going to limit future damage by capping carbon emissions? And one thing you, of course, suggest, and others have suggested, is raising the price of fossil fuels.
How's that
possible? How can
we do that?
Well,
it's only possible if we get a political decision from our Congress and our president and from parliaments, legislatures, politburos, monarchies around the world to join into a likewise international agreement. It's very difficult. It won't happen without a broad movement to demand it. That's what we're trying to build. There are some signs that it's possible to build that kind of movement. Last October at 350.org, we coordinated what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history, 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries. This October, 10-10-10, we're doing a global work party, and in thousands of places people will be putting up solar panels or digging community gardens or all kinds of things, not because we think we can stop climate change one solar panel at a time. We can't. As you point out, it will take a change in the price of carbon to reflect the damage it does in the atmosphere. But we want to use that work party not only to get good things done, but to send a pretty sharp message to our leaders. We're getting to work. What about you? And that's why people are signing up in droves all around the world at 350.org.
That was author, journalist, and climate change activist Bill McKibben. Learn more about the October 10th Day of Action on Climate Change Solutions by visiting the website 350.org. Bill McKibben's latest book is titled Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.